1982, and I'm talking to Justice John Diamond. I wanted to ask you about the function of the local bars before there was the Integrated Bar Act. What did they do?
They didn't do much of anything. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think back. The Integrated Bar Act came in 1953 or 55. Calvarides, who died, Judge Calvarides, was in the legislature at the time, and he was the prime mover to get the Integrated Bar Act passed. He did a good job. But one difference was in this discipline of members of the bar who had violated the canons of ethics in some way. The bar didn't handle it. It was reported to the judge, Judge Folder, for example. And he would report to the district attorney, and the district attorney would talk to the judge, and they'd arrange a hearing at which the question is whether this man should be punished or disbarred or fined or reprimanded or whatever decree was available for having done something contrary to the ethics of the profession. And it was a regular trial in court. District attorney representing the, I guess, the people of Alaska, and the lawyer sought to be disbarred or being represented by another attorney. And that was the difference, really. After the Integrated Bar came into effect, the bar made their rules, they were adopted by the Supreme Court, and the bar conducts its own internal disciplinary proceedings. They have committees set up. They have regular hearing and trial. And then they make a recommendation to the Supreme Court as to whether this man should be reprimanded privately or publicly, whether he should be suspended from the practice of law or disbarred. And that is final. Once the Supreme Court acts on that, that's the end of it. He can always petition later to be readmitted. That's up to the discretion of the Supreme Court.
Was there a big difference in disciplinary proceedings, not the proceedings themselves, but the number of people that were brought up for disciplinary proceedings before and after?
I can't answer that question. I don't know what the... When I took office in 1959, I don't remember. I only remember one case. Neil McKay was disbarred by this court, not by the, in fact, the Board of Governors recommended he not be disbarred. And the Supreme Court took the case away from them, in fact, said we're the final persons that you have to contact to find out. We disbarred Neil McKay, what he'd done. Later he was reinstated, quite a bit later. It caused a terrible clash between the bar and the court. The Under Chief Justice Nesbitt, the bar assets were seized, and the Supreme Court started to run the Bar Association. And the bar would not have anything to do with that, and they caused such a furor that the American Bar Association sent three distinguished people to Alaska to see if they couldn't settle the controversy. We had the Chief Justice of the Supreme Courts of Washington and Oregon, and an eminent lawyer named, I can't remember his name now, from Seattle.
Schwepe.
And they did a good job. They finally got together here in Juneau with the bar. Bob Ziegler was president at the time, so he didn't remember it. And we settled the controversy, with the bar being responsible, as they are now, for disciplinary matters, the ultimate decree to come from the court, and the bar to provide rules which the Supreme Court may or may not consent to. I think the Supreme Court has consented to almost every rule change that the bar has asked for, as far as I know. But it was a very bad feeling. Justice Aaron was defeated on that account. He ran that year. The bar took up the cudgel and ran TV ads, radio spots, and so on, and had programs on television which made him look like a horrible sort of man. But he's a very fine man, really. I thought it was unfair the way they went about defeating him, because they didn't tell the whole truth. But then that's in the past, and it's too bad that Harry had to run that year for election. If I'd been running, I'd been defeated also, so would Nesbitt. But I had two more years. This happened in 1965. I was retained in 1962 for 10 years, so my time wasn't up till 72. Before that time, I'd retired from the court because of my health. I never sat on a disciplinary proceeding before statehood. I mean, not before statehood, but before the integrated bar came into effect, so I don't know just how they handle this thing. I do remember a man named Bill Stump in Ketchikan, who you may have heard about, who was Judge Fola, and the district attorney prosecuted him, in effect, for violating certain ethical standards of the bar, and the judge found him guilty. He didn't use the word guilty, but that's what it amounted to, and suspended him for a certain length of time.
What was he supposed to have done?
He's supposed to have threatened the legislator if he didn't vote for a bill or not vote for a bill or something, there was going to be trouble. It was a threat. That's all I remember about it. I can't remember the name of the person. He was in Ketchikan. Bill, a longtime legislator from Ketchikan. I can't recall his last name now. I'll think of it after a while.
Was what he did something that someone would have been suspended from the bar for now?
Yes, I think so. I don't think the result would make any difference, the integrated bar or not. There weren't many cases, as I recall, practicing in Juneau, of lawyers being disbarred or suspended or reprimanded. That's the only one that comes to mind, as a matter of fact.
During the court bar fight, how did you feel about what was happening?
Well, I was very much distressed by it. It upset me because we'd always been a close-knit group of people. I knew all the members of the bar those times, or most of them. And I was glad to see the American Bar Association send these three men up. And I had a lot to do, I think, at the final meeting here in December of 65, to accept the solution these people had suggested about making rules, let the bar make the rules, the court adopt them. The bar handles internal grievance procedures, and if it's something beyond a reprimand or something, they go to the Supreme Court for further action.
Did you
In other words, they do not recommend to the court that this man be suspended for 5 years. And then the court might make it 8 years or 3 years. And there's been no complaint from the bar that I know of. I think probably, in one sense, it was a good thing because it brought to the attention of the bar that the Supreme Court felt it was not handling its own internal problems like it should. There weren't very many complaints or hearings against lawyers and so on, and so the Supreme Court decided to take the whole thing over. And that caused such an eruption that it ended up back in the bar's hands, but in that intervening period they had time to think about it. And the bar and the court are rather good relations now.
Has the bar improved as far as disciplining it?
I think it has, yes.
So you think it was necessary for that at least show to get the bar moving?
I don't know whether that was necessary, but it's the only way we could think about
so it was
at the time. That was the purpose of it.
Was it a cohesive action of the court?
Many yes.
people will say that, or I've heard that Chief Justice Nesbitt was the motivating force.
He was a motivating force. He was a very strong-willed and dominant personality. And I have to admit that he would sway me sometimes with the force of his argumentation. He was a tough man. But he did an awfully good job in setting up the court system. That's what people forget. He came down to Juneau with a copy of the bill in his hand. No money, no paper clips, no desk, no chair, anything. He said, organize the court system. So he and I worked together night and day, weekends, holidays, and everything else to get the court system organized. And we started in July and had our Supreme Court rules in effect and Supreme Court open for duty in October. And then we had all the Superior Courts manned by judges and the clerks and so on by February, 1960. And since that time, there have been so many new judges. I don't even know all the judges now, particularly in Anchorage.
When did he start looking at the bar, or when did the court start looking at the bar and deciding?
Well, that was, I think that was in 1964. I'm not sure.
So it really had to do with the Neil McKay case.
Was that such
an outrage?
Well, we thought at the time it was, yes. But the bar felt differently because they had recommended no discipline for McKay. Mm-hmm. And we held that he was entitled, or should be disciplined. I think we made a mistake in the sense that we should have not gone so speedily. We should have taken it up with the integrated bar first and let them know what our feelings were and then discuss the whole matter, maybe iron it out in some way. But Nabil had all the papers ready and he called me up to Anchorage and said, sign here. And we discussed it a little bit and it sounded logical to me, so I signed the papers. Wish I hadn't now.
What about Harry Aaron?
Yes, he was in favor of it. The reason I didn't like the attack on Harry, they implied very vividly that he was not an honest man, that he was a dictator type of person and didn't have the temperament for a judge and so on, which was all false. But it was the only way people could be changed to, or could be persuaded to vote against him, I guess. Ordinarily, in this setup we have, it's called the Michigan system, where the judges are appointed by the governor, with the council's meeting, by the way, judicial council down the hall. They send names up to the governor appoints from those names only. Under that system, very few judges have been, no judge except Harry Aaron has ever been defeated. In fact, the judicial council makes a recommendation during an election, or before the election, as to whether Judge so-and-so should be retained for another 6 years or 10 years. And they get a questionnaire and circulate it among the whole bar and the Peace Officers Association, I think, generally trying to get to jurors who've been, I'm not sure about the jurors, whether they can, too many people serve on that to find out who they were. But Judge Williams downstairs was twice recommended against retention by the bar. The people got angry in Juneau because they liked him, and he got a big vote to stay in office both times. In fact, I wrote a letter for him. I differed with the council. I think his only trouble was he was a little bit tougher than some judges on sentences. You know, this misdemeanor of speeding, traffic cases, and so on.
I'm going to take us back a bit.
Sure.
From that time period. I wanted to ask you about a few of the people who were in Juneau before statehood practicing law. And I wanted to start with Mildred Herman.
Yes, Mildred Herman was before statehood. Henry Roden practiced for a while. He ended up in the government service.
As Attorney General?
Yes, Attorney General and later Treasurer. I knew Henry quite well. I liked the old man. He was getting up in years when he died. He was probably 80-some. And he spoke with he was from Switzerland. He spoke with either a mixed French and German accent. I couldn't determine which it was. It was probably German, but you could understand him. And he'd been in Alaska for many, many years. He'd been up at Iditarod and Flat and Dillingham and places like that. And let's see, who was Norman Banfield. R.E. Robertson, they called him Bob Robertson.
What was he like?
Bob Robertson was a good attorney. He was an older man compared to me. He was Fred Easton's
father-in-law.
And he was a good attorney. He did a good job. He had a good clientele. And his partner, Mike Monagle, the same way. The only difference between Mike and Bob were one's a Republican, one's a Democrat. But Mike is retired now. I haven't seen him for a long time. And Fred Eastall. Then in our firm we had Banfield, Bruchier, Frank Dugan, who died last year or 2 years ago.
Can you tell me a little bit about Frank Dugan?
Frank Dugan was a very fine man. He was born in Juneau. Came from a family of about 12 children. And they're all fine kids. I know all of them. His mother was a real wonderful woman. His father died when they were young, and I think the other brothers helped Frank get through law school. They thought Ed wanted to be a lawyer, and so they said, well, if we gather together, we can send one through school, but not the others. That's the way it happened with my wife. Their father was dead, and they had to bring all the money home to the mother to take care of a daughter who had tuberculosis. So the sacrifices were made in those days to help people out. Frank was a good lawyer, too.
He did go to law school.
Yes, he went to Spokane. Catholic school there. I forget the name of it. Gonzaga, yeah. My daughter went there for 3 years. We got married. And now regrets not having finished. But let's see, there was Norman, Bob, Frank, and then myself. We were the Faulkner, Manfield, and Dugan firm. And Faulkner had retired and gone to San Francisco.
Now, was the Faulkner, Banfield, and Dugan firm Republican firm?
The father, Faulkner, Banfield, Bucheever, and Dugan. Faulkner and Banfield were Republicans, and Dugan and Bucheever and I were Democrats. That didn't have anything to do with our job, so. Mm-hmm.
So you didn't let politics interfere with your practice?
Oh, no. I don't remember any case at all where that happened. Mm-hmm. Then Howard Stabler and his wife, she was a lawyer, mm-hmm. practiced law. And Bill Paul, junior Bill Paul, his father was a well-known native leader. Bill was part native and part white. Mm-hmm. He's a good lawyer. He went south quite a few years ago. And
do you remember his father?
Yes.
What was he like?
He was a lawyer too at one time and was disbarred years and years ago and then readmitted years later.
Why was he disbarred?
I can't remember what it was. It
was he a Juneau lawyer?
Yes. He was a full-blooded Indian, mm-hmm. a Tlingit Indian, and a lawyer. And he didn't practice law very much. His main source was trying to get these native claims for the Indians. He spent years and years on that, mm-hmm. trying to get the Indians reimbursed for the lands that had been taken by the government from them. And of course, after his death, this Alaska Native Claims Act was passed, you know. And so his efforts had a lot to do with that, I think. Some people didn't like him, Norman Banfield for one, but you have to talk to him about that. He didn't think much of young Bill Paul either.
What about Fred Paul?
Well, Fred went to Seattle and is still practicing law there. And he's a good attorney, as far as I know. I don't know him very well. I don't know. He really practiced up here for a while. I went to Seattle and passed the Washington Bar.
Were there any other native attorneys? Would they be
the
only ones?
They're the only ones. Ray Manson, Judge Ray Manson of Kodiak, is part Indian. And I can't think of any other native attorneys. There are some new ones in Anchorage, some of the younger people whom I don't know. You may have had one in your class. I don't know. I'm glad to see it. I wish that more of them had the money to go to school. And because they're intelligent people, you know, they're not dumb by any means. I can't think of anybody else. Who practiced here? Bob Annis.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about Bob Annis?
Bob Annis was a good lawyer, and he started out as an assistant to the Attorney General, like most of us did, to make
a letter. Or to Ralph Rivers?
No, it was George Williams. Mm-hmm. And was in charge of mostly the aviation part of Alaska's government that dealt with airplanes and so on. And Bob was found dead in his hotel room not too many years ago in Anchorage. That's all I know. I don't know how he died or anything else. Tom Stewart called me one morning and said they found Bob in his room. He was dead.
Do you
No, I didn't know Grover Wayne. I know his son, his daughter. But, I never knew him. I didn't live in Juneau when I was young. But I heard a lot of things about him. I've forgotten most of them, I guess.
Do you remember any of them?
No, I can't really recall. People tell stories about him, funny things that happened, but I can't remember what they were.
Would be a good person to talk to about him.
Banfield.
George Grigsby, was he down here?
In the very early days, he was here, but I knew him best in Anchorage. Mm-hmm. When I went up there and was trying to think of the names of people that were members of the bar at the time I first went back in 1946. Grigsby was quite active at that time, and he gradually failed. He was a very entertaining person. He and my dad used to like to get together and tell stories of the early days in Alaska. There's one story that either Grigsby or my father told me about a judge in Nome, whose name I forgot, was asked whether so-and-so could be admitted to the bar. And the man said, "Hell no, there are enough scoundrels at the bar now."
Referring to Grigsby?
No, I don't know. What might it be? Because some other lawyer. So you have different type of courts and judges and lawyers and everything else. And I like George. I took him home once from a bar meeting where we had a little whiskey there, and he got a little bit drunk. And it was winter time, below zero. I was afraid he was walking home, so I drove him home. Took him in, and his wife thought I was a cab driver, and she was real rude to me and told me to get out and leave him to her. And so that's what I did. I never met her after that, so I don't know.
Was that
an
Anchorage?
That was an Anchorage. Well, Stanley McCutcheon in Anchorage was one of the early ones there, too. Bill Nesbitt, Stanley McCutcheon, McCary, Robinson, I forget the rest of them.
What was, in territorial days, what was the reputation of these Anchorage lawyers like McCutcheon and Grigsby and Renfrew, McCary, in Juneau? What did Juneau think of Anchorage Bar?
I don't think they had any particular thoughts about it. I never heard any discussion about Anchorage lawyers.
Did they have associations with Anchorage lawyers at all? Did they have offices with them?
No. There were no Anchorage lawyers here at the time, and no junior lawyers in Anchorage like they have now. Mm-hmm. There was a pipeline explosion. Banfield opened an office in Anchorage. East opened one there. And somebody else here had an office in Anchorage. I forget who it is now. And Bob Eady's down here. He has an office down here. I don't know all the members of the Juneau Bar anymore. I lost track of them.
Did they all have separate clients in the territorial days? Did the Juneau Bar have a distinct clientele and the Anchorage Bar have distinct?
Well, after the war, during the war, Anchorage started to boom, and all the troops came there. And it was a pretty rough town for a while. And then after the war in 1945, Anchorage is starting to grow. I don't know what caused it. It became the international aviation spot for planes from Japan and over in Europe to stop and refuel at Anchorage. And more business came there, construction business, and the government spent money around Anchorage. Now I suppose the population's what is it, 150,000 or?
Yeah, it's really big.
Something like that, I forget. And I don't think the type of business was different, except that some lawyers here had fishing, fish-related businesses, which they didn't have too much in Anchorage. But there was a regular routine job a lawyer has. I found out as a private practitioner that it wasn't very lucrative. Unless you get the retainers from the big firms, big companies, it's pretty hard to make a living here. It was then.
Yeah.
Now these lawyers seem to do pretty well. I don't know how it is. Juneau's been booming too in the last 10 years. It's been increased in population.
Did that pipeline money too?
I suppose it filters down here. I don't know what keeps Juneau going really, except the capital. You've got quite a few more employees than you did in 1945. And the capital has grown, more departments, more people hired, more homes being built. And I suppose there are 20,000 people here now. When I came down there, it might have been 10,000. So.
I wanted to ask you about lawyers in politics and the role. Did lawyers feel that once they were lawyers that they should be in politics, they should have parties and be part of a party and be active? Was there some sort of...
Some of them did. And it used to be that quite a few lawyers ran for election in the legislature. I remember Max Stepovich being a senator, and who else was down there? Paul Robinson was in the legislature one time. Henry Roden was in the 1913 House of Representatives. That's the first one we had. I have the session laws of that time. My father was a lawyer and also a representative in the legislature. Gerald Murray, Valdez. You were talking about Juneau, though. I'm trying to think of all the attorneys that served. Ralph Rivers served before he became Attorney General. L.B. Ray, I think, was in the legislature in the early days, yes. The Donahoes weren't. They kept the home fires burning while my father spent his time down here. We used to come down with him and run a house, and just live here and go to school here during the session.
I'm going to ditch you off track a little. What were the Donahoes like?
They were sort of a well-to-do family. I don't know where the money had come from, because I know that Ruth Donahoe, young Tom's sister, who's now in the late 60s, I'd say, or early 70s, has always seemed to be well off, and I don't know what work she's ever done. Very nice person. Their home is really in California, around Palo Alto. But the old man, I didn't know him too well. He had palsy when I knew him. And he was quite active in politics. He was the National Democratic Chairman for Alaska at one time. My father was a Democrat, of course. And young Tom also. But I'd have to think a little bit about who were lawyers in the Alaska legislature. They took greater interest the last 15, 20 years than they have the last few years. There aren't too many lawyers there now. I don't know if there are any. There might be some in the legislature.
Did you ever gravitate toward politics?
No, I kept out of politics. My father had his fill of it, and I just didn't like it. I don't know why I rebelled against it, and I never have been in politics, except this job, which was political in a way. I don't know why Bill Egan appointed me, unless it was because he and I grew up in Valdez together. Possibly. He's a couple years older than I am.
Did people have different, such a leading question. Did people have a different regard for lawyers? Has it changed? Has the role of lawyer changed?
I don't think so. I don't think so, no.
In the early years, they thought about lawyers just as they do today. And lawyers have a fairly borderline.
Yeah, they're not thought well of by most people today or yesterday, that is years ago.
Even in territorial days, they didn't think much of lawyers.
All I can think about is Valdez, and I think they had the same attitude. Except my father knew so many people that were friendly with him that he was liked and respected as a lawyer. L.V. Ray came over from Seward, and he was a good man. And a fellow named Reed, who practiced in Valdez, who committed suicide. And his son's still alive somewhere in California. I forget where he lives.
Was Reed practicing? Is he a contemporary of your father?
Yes, he was practicing at that time. I just happened to think of his name.
Yeah, I'd never heard of him.
I forget his first name. His son's name is Richard Reed. I don't know what his father's name was. I don't know what caused the tragedy, but that's what happened. They weren't making too much money, those lawyers. Valdez. My father never did have very much. When he was elected to Congress, they didn't pay big salaries in those days. And he had three children to send through. He thought should go through college, and which they did. Two girls and a boy. And then when he was elected delegate to Congress, stayed there 12 years. When he came back, I was overseas at the time. He came back in 44 as a judge in Anchorage. And he had to borrow money from me to get back to Anchorage.
Really?
All my income had gone into a bank in Seattle from overseas. There was no place to spend money over there. So, I kept a few dollars for myself. I remember my mother writing and my father asking if it'd be all right. And I said, heaven's sakes, take it all if you want.
Yeah.
They had a joint account with me.
Were there some lawyers who were making money?
I don't think in Valdez they were making money, making enough for a living, support a family, but they weren't making the big money that some of those firms are making now in Anchorage. You've got firms up there with 20 or 30 lawyers in them, and they've got to be making awfully good money to support that many people.
What about in territorial days? Were any lawyers making good money?
Well, I think the two firms here made pretty good money. And in Ketchikan, Ziegler and Claudie, that was Aiden's son, Bob, I think did too well. They had the corporate clients also, the insurance companies and fishing interests and so on, sawmill. Then Bob Jernberg made good money down there. And his former partner, I forget his name.
Lester Gore,
yeah. Took Bob in, and then Lester died, and Bob just practiced by himself, I think, most of the time. He's retired now, too. He lives in California somewhere.
Do judges, I know that Lester Gore had been a judge up in Nome, and then he went back to practice.
Yes.
Yeah. Ketchikan.
Yeah.
Is there any problem with the judge practicing, going back and practicing?
You don't hear about it too often. I'm trying to think of any judges, prior judges who are practicing. I can't recall anybody now. There have been several who retired, but they've had enough monetary background from their trial practices, mostly. You see what happened, particularly in Anchorage, and also in Juneau and Ketchikan to some extent. The lawyer who practiced long enough would acquire property as fees. And once your property is always worth money, and it appreciates in value ever since it was retained back in those days. And I listened to a couple of judges once on an airplane talking about their holdings down in Kenai and their so on and so forth. And they're independently well off. And of course, being a judge doesn't really mean that much to them, as far as the salary is concerned. But I didn't practice long enough to acquire anything like that, so I had to live on my salary.
Did people actually pay the lawyers with the property?
Usually they didn't have any money, and the lawyer would say, well, if I recover this property for you, how about you paying off by giving me so many acres? And that's the way it happened. I know Bill Nesbitt had property in Kenai. Ralph Moody has some down there. I think Paul Robinson owns property around Anchorage. Wendell Kay probably does also. George Mooney, who was dead now, had some property interests. You see, lawyers had the first crack at that. I mean, if a client needed some help, it was going to be a very expensive lawsuit. He'd bargain with the land, and the lawyer would be delighted to take land, you know. Smells awfully dry.
Are there, besides land, were there any other interests that lawyers had that made the money?
Bill Nesbitt got involved with a coal mine, but he made money, and then after statehood, he had a fight with the Department of Interior and lost it, and had to repay quite a bit of the money
that
he made on it. But he's not hurting at all. He gets a good retirement plus the land value he's got up in Alaska still. He comes back every year. He's blind in one eye, and both legs were shattered. And he walks pretty well. Airplane accident. His plane crashed in 1969.
So after he'd become judge.
Yes. Yeah, he flew his own plane, and he and the administrative director went out fishing out of Anchorage, and all of a sudden the plane stalled out, and he just fell to the ground. And something went through his eye. It was terribly painful for you. He wouldn't have it taken out for a long time, the eye. But he was a stoic and never complained about anything. They finally took the eye out, and I don't even think he uses a cane anymore. His little legs were pretty well broken. But, he was commander of a destroyer in the war. He was a sort of a tough man, you know. He had some of that concept of authority, which as Chief Justice, as he had during the war, as a commander of a fighting ship, you know.
As an Associate Justice, what were you on the ship?
I wasn't on the ship.
But as an Associate Justice on the court, how did he treat the Associate Justice?
Well, we treated him fine. Yeah. I never had any trouble with Buell. In fact, I admire the work the man did to get this court system going. I think sober lawyers would admit that to the older crowd, preferably. Well, Weichel was a lawyer up in Anchorage, too, I forgot. He came up fairly early.
He has a very colorful reputation.
A colorful man, yes. It's fascinating to watch him try a lawsuit. He's a brilliant person. And he walks the edge very carefully, you know. But he and John Helenthal can be very biting in court. They're two lawyers who don't care about your feelings at all, you know. There aren't too many lawyers who practice that way anymore.
More lawyers used to practice that way?
Yeah.
What is it then? Can you describe it?
Well, sarcastic remarks made to the lawyer, and interruptions constantly, and I objection to this, object to that, you know, and have quarrels, sort of quarrel in the courtroom until the judge stops them. And
is it showmanship?
I suppose so, yes. They think it's a way to win their cases. So. And Wendell Kay was not exactly like that. He was a very good criminal lawyer, but even though he could be firm and angry, he also had a good sense of humor. And he was somebody everybody liked. You know, the lawyers all respected him and liked him. He's another one that came up when I was there. I think Wendell came up with the Alaska Housing Authority, the attorney for them. He went in with Warren Cuddy. It was, then Dan came and joined the firm. And Mr. Cuddy died and Dan took over the bank. And Wendell has had different partners since then. I don't know who they are.
Robinson used to be a partner, Paul Robinson.
Paul did.